when I train candidates, if they come to me and ask, which they don't always do, I always say, take Freud. Start with Freud. Learn the interpersonalist. Learn the object relations, folks. Know from what you come, even if you want to be a radical interpersonalist, a radical relationalist, because having that stuff in your back pocket is organizing and creates an ideal to which you can aspire or choose not to follow, but at least you'll know what you're not following. So my perspective on this stuff really comes from the idea that before we are free to break the rules, we need to know what the rules are, and we need to be well-grounded in them.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Joyce Schlackauer. And we discuss the subject of termination. Termination as it has been taught for many years, and how it has been practiced for many years, both in the past and in the present. And our focus is on a current paper of hers in the Psychoanalytic Quarterly entitled Ending, Not Quite Ending, and Not Ending at All. And as you will hear, our discussion traces the evolution of various concepts in psychoanalysis, termination being the focus of our attention. Dr. Schlackauer is on the faculty and supervisor at the NYU postdoctoral program, the Stephen Mitchell Center, the National Training Program of NIP, the Philadelphia Center for Relational Studies, and the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California in San Francisco. She is also a professor emerita of psychology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at City University of New York. She has written widely. One book is Holding in Psychoanalysis, a Relational Perspective, also Psychoanalytic Collisions. And she is co-editor with Lou Aaron and Sue Grand, a book entitled De-idealizing Relational Theory, a Critique from Within, and Decentering Relational Theory, a Comparative Critique, both of which received the Gradiva Award in 2019. Her latest book, Psychoanalysis and the Unspoken, was published in 2024. She is in private practice in Manhattan. And as my prior conversations with Joyce went, I found them deeply engaging and analytically rich, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Joyce, welcome to the podcast. It's lovely to have you back again.
And a pleasure for me.
We're going to be discussing a current paper you have about the subject of termination. And what you write about is how termination has changed in recent times in our field, both the concept of it and indeed the practice of it. And you couch termination in the context of many other presumed essentials of our field. Indeed, we could call them shibboleths. There are certain premises that we have been taught that are deemed to be essential for an analytic process to take place. And we are discovering that it's not so binary. It's not so black and white. And we will go through a number of those along our way to discussing termination through your paper. The through line that runs through your paper, as I read it, is about your own evolution in relation to what you call, and many people call, their analytic superego. But you have a much nicer way to say it. You call it the psychoanalytic police that were sitting on my shoulder far too heavily, I think. And we've all been through that. And I think it's important that we, and you do this in your paper, that we keep a focus on the necessary guidelines, the guidelines that we practice with and that we teach that are necessary to help us create and maintain a very unique, indeed odd relationship, the analytic relationship. It's not like any other. And it does take training and guidelines. The problem is that guidelines has been mistranslated into rules.
Yes.
And as you point out, rules so easily fall into the binary of submission or rebellion, which is in neither the analyst or the analysand's best interest. So we're faced with a challenge, and that is, how do we teach that it isn't the rules, it isn't the theory, it's observing how our interventions are received by the analysand, the patient, and to see if our interventions result in a deepening of the experience. A deepening, not according to theory, but according to the patient's associations. Do they have new senses, new memories, new ideas, new affects? And that's what I hear you fundamentally saying, making a case for guidelines that have the flexibility of guidelines. Before I jump in, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in. So I agree with you, but I also think that it is not true that we don't need the rules. We need the rules. If we didn't have the rules, well, goodness knows enough awful stuff happens despite the rules. If we didn't have the rules, just imagine what could happen. I think the question is how to hold the rules as sort of inspirational guidelines rather than, the 11th, 12th, and 15th commandments. They're not thou shalt not, but rather think about this and pause before you do it because it really violates our vision of what it means to be in an analytic relationship.
I think we're agreeing.
I do.
It may be whether, you know, there are capital letters for rules or capital letters for guidelines, how strict they are. But inspiration is the key word. They want to inspire us to listen carefully. And if we listen carefully, I maintain that we won't do things that harm patients or ourselves.
Yes, I agree.
And I'm open to that debate for sure. Mm-hmm. So to begin, you write in this paper, a lot has happened since the 1980s. For one, relational and interpersonal theories that emphasize the dyadic element has shifted our approach to psychoanalytic rules. For another, candidates live in a very different sociocultural time characterized by a broad shift away from rigid hierarchy. Few feel compelled to reflexively follow rules, and as, if not more important, very few patients are prepared to accede to the kind of hierarchical, authoritative stance today that then dominated the field. In fact, patients often are unwilling to let us set the rules unilaterally. Many argue, negotiate, question. And this is, I think, largely for the good. Good place to jump off. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I want to start by saying that the term analytic police was first coined by Muriel Dimon. So I don't want to take that credit away from you. It's a wonderful concept. And then, yeah, I think a little bit like when I train candidates, if they come to me and ask, which they don't always do, I always say, take Freud, start with Freud, learn the interpersonalist, learn the object relations, folks, know from what you come, even if you want to be a radical interpersonalist, a radical relationalist, because having that stuff in your back pocket is organizing and creates an ideal to which you can aspire or choose not to follow. But at least you'll know what you're not following. So My perspective on this stuff really comes from the idea that before we are free to break the rules, we need to know what the rules are, and we need to be well grounded in them.
I think that's importantly true. I mean, it's true for improvisation in music. You really have to study Bach to know how to improvise. And that's, I think that's your point.
That is right.
And in fact, yeah, you go on exactly. to say in the paper, few of us have entirely abandoned the ground rules that once guided virtually every aspect of the analytic frame, even those who, like me, identify mm-hmm. with the relational perspective. You go on to say, today, flexibility can be found in nearly every dimension of analytic practice and across most clinical theories. For example, I'm far more likely to answer patients' questions than I was. Yes, I inquire first. I ask what my patient imagines the answer might be, how they would feel were I to confirm or disconfirm their anticipation. Sometimes I feel there's a good reason not to answer, and I don't. But I no longer say no reflexively. Before we go into an example you have about Mary, tell us more about your thinking and how it has evolved.
You know, I was trained at a time when I would have gotten into such big trouble if I answered patients' questions. It was loud and clear from every supervisor I had, including, incidentally, my interpersonal supervisor, that we needed to hold the frame. And the thing about that that was problematic was it stopped us interrogating the why. Patient wants to know, I have to say no, can't answer. So what I never got to in that early time was the question, what's behind the question? What is it that my patient really wants to know? And what would the consequence be of answering or not answering?
And you say that now you've told me offline that you tilt towards answering. Can you fill that out for us?
Yeah. I mean, look, of course, there are things that I wouldn't. A patient says to me, you know, what's your sex life like? I'm going to go, well, what do you think my sex life is like? I'm not going to answer that because it's so obviously provocative and right, invites all kinds of trouble. But it seems to me that the question when a patient asks me something is, what do they really want to find out? Mm-hmm. Sometimes what they want to find out is whether I'm willing to answer their question because they grew up in a home that was completely rule-bound, where boundaries could not be crossed. On the other hand, we may have somebody who grew up in a home where there were no boundaries. And those experiences are going to play out in the way that patients ask or don't ask questions, and they're going to inform what I'm going to do. If I have a patient who grew up in a home without rules, I'm much more likely to kind of stick to the frame, if possible, flexibly, but still stick to it. Whereas somebody on the other side, in a way, I'm going to want to answer to give them a taste of what it feels like to be in a relationship that has some elasticity.
I think we're saying the same thing. My words would be that for patients who use the rules to stay in a sort of schizoid non-involvement, for me mm-hmm. to maintain an anonymity of the sort we're talking about just supports their character defense. And so
yes,
challenging
precisely.
It would be by answering the question and challenging their comfort in the anonymity so that we could get to mm-hmm. the anxiety about being in relation to each other. But then there are others who really
yes.
don't have that schizoid avoidance and are able to imagine productively and have a fantasy life, which it then makes sense to me not to answer. So I think we're saying the same thing.
The only thing that I would, I think I'm sure we're saying the same thing, but
right,
what
right.
I would add to that is that in addition to thinking about what the meaning would be to the patient of my answering or not answering, there's also the question of the dyadic element. How are we relating to each other, patient and me, and what would we play out were I to answer or not to answer? In other words, there's the possibility coming in it from a more relational perspective of saying, all right, well, so what would it feel like if I answered? Not to analyze it, but to really kind of deepen our understanding of the impact of what the patient wants on me and vice versa. Table in earlier years. Couldn't do it.
I was just thinking the same thing. One of the pleasures and beauty of this conversation is that we are having it. And back in the day, we couldn't have this. There was just one answer. And that's too bad for all the patients who could have benefited by having questions answered and the flexibility shown.
Yes, without that meaning.
Yes, you write about Mary. You say, when I recently announced an upcoming break to my patient Mary, she asked why I was traveling, as this was not an ordinary vacation period. Suspecting that a lot was embedded in that question, I asked her what her guess was. And you make a parenthetical note that you didn't say fantasy. I'll ask you about that in a minute. She said she suspected I was presenting at a conference, but she wasn't sure. I asked, how would she feel if that were the case? And if it were a vacation trip, you asked? Mary paused and said, well, if you're going on a work trip, I want to know. I like imagining you doing the kind of thing I will when I finish training. But if you're going away with family, I'd feel so jealous and left out. Wait, I changed my mind. Don't tell me. Now, you go on to reflect on that exchange, and it's a lovely exchange. Can you flesh it out a little bit? It's a little neat, because she sort of gets you off the hot seat by saying, no, I'm not going to push this, even though she said, I would want to know, which sounded strongly expressed. Tell us more about this.
So I actually think, yes, she got me off the hook, and in that sense, it's neat. But I think that the important piece has nothing to do with whether I tell her or don't tell her. The important piece had to do with the fact that by my not saying no and not saying yes, she found space within which to really explore what drove her question and what was behind it. Had I said no, she would have been in reaction to a rigid withholding analyst. I just said, listen, I'm going to the Alps. That would have been the end of any conversation that had to do with her experience in a way that we could have explored. So for me, the value is in that open space between the two, not in whether I actually answer or don't.
It's sort of like you're saying, how would you feel if I did X and how would you feel if I did Y?
Yeah. And then we'll figure out what I should do.
Right. Now, tell us about, note that I didn't say fantasy.
So I have, perhaps in part as a result of my very early training, a somewhat allergic reaction to ways of intervening that leave the patient feeling potentially pathologized. You say, what's your fantasy about where I'm going? As if it is something now to become the subject of analysis, meaning it's not coming out of what my patients know about me, and it tilts the relationship. It leaves the patient in the lower position and the analyst in the superior, knowing, capable of analyzing position. And that is why I do not like it. So I ask her where she imagines I'm going. She can tell me whatever she wants.
Right. Let me see. We have to stop this agreeing. Let me see if we agree on this. I never use the word fantasy either because, A, it's a jargon word. It has all kinds of meaning to the practitioner. And we assume, if not demand, that patients understand it as we think they do, and they don't. Right. And it's more experience distant. So I say, what do you imagine? And I think... And that's closer to the human experience. We all have imaginings, whatever fantasies are or aren't. So I think we agree again, Joyce. But
do you agree? The thing is, imagining is not pathologizing. Fantasy suggests it's not realistic. It's separated from anything that's grounded in reality.
And
would
it
not
also
make me want to answer.
And it has tinges of sexuality. You know, what's your sexual fantasy? And that takes off in that other direction, which is beside the point.
Yes.
And just to show your balanced thinking, you go on to say, like all good things, analytic flexibility can become excessive. We can fail to pause before entering the clinical moment. We can exclude our own investment in being nice or in sidestepping a patient's anger. We can move away from a focus on unconscious anxieties and too quickly accept the manifest at face value. And we can override or fail to recognize the impact of our flexibility on us. In all these ways, we run the risk of sidelining our own self-interest and or needs in a way that may come back to bite, that can leave us feeling frustrated or resentful. With that, the paper goes to the termination itself. And you write, during analytic training, I was taught to approach termination with the same kind of firm boundaries that were applied to virtually every aspect of the treatment model. A proper ending required a far-off termination date so that we could work through the transference residue. Premature or abrupt terminations were signs of resistance and should be analyzed. And once we ended for good, period. So how did that go? When you tried to apply that model, how did it go?
Not real well. Right. And it didn't go real well on both ends. Some patients, you know, and I was very, very young, and my supervisor said, you know, basically, you cannot do these 15 things. I had a patient who walked. I think I describe it in the paper. It was a patient who discovered this Cambodian rice paper rubbing that was hanging in my office and wanted to know where I got it, and I wouldn't tell her. It was so dumb. She's an artist. It was beautiful and it was very unusual. And I wouldn't tell her because I wasn't supposed to tell her. And she left. She never came back because I am sure her conclusion was this rigid withholding therapist, I'm not going to her.
Well, and perhaps she was in her own way, she was an artist and she saw some artisticness in you that she was trying to be like mm-hmm. you, to emulate you. And the no was to, perhaps, I'm assuming, imagining, was to say, we're not going to go there. We're not going to discover your wishes to share that kind of intimacy with me. And her walking makes sense under those conditions.
It does. And it may have been that she wanted to emulate me. It may have been that she found a like subject element. We both liked art and was trying to establish a better connection with me. I mean, we had just met. So here was a way in which we were similar. We both liked art. And I'm like, nope, you can't be similar to me there. And it could have felt like a massive rejection. Of course, I'll never know. Yeah.
One of the things I enjoy about your writing is you are eminently practical and you're also conceptually attuned. For example, about the issue of termination, you reflect and you say, if a capacity for deep attachment rather than separation per se is a sign of maturity that needn't reflect undifferentiated merger, complete endings no longer seem the single right way to go. For some, of course, they are. Being able to go it alone represents an extraordinary achievement. But for others, sustaining a connection over time is far more valuable. Now, this is talking about challenging shibboleths. You're saying that for some people, staying in touch with their analyst after termination, if I understand this right, is not a problem, not a sign of pathology or ego weakness, but a sign of maturity. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, I think when I wrote it, I was, first of all, talking not so much about post-analytic connectedness, but the notion that the analysis has to come to an end. And asking the question, does it always have to come to an end? Or might there be people who need to sustain the connection with the analyst over time because attachment has been such a developmental issue? Whether that means that the patient essentially stays in treatment in something that at least looks like treatment beyond the point when they, quote, need it, or seeks out a relationship with the analyst post-treatment, I have hesitancy about the latter, even though I think it sometimes is okay and maybe even better than okay. But the notion that I stand behind 100% is that the idea that what is good is ending and what is problematic is staying attached, I think is utterly wrong.
Well, let me ask you to flesh out a little bit your comment about something that may look like treatment, referring to people who stay on in some form. What did you have in mind with that?
I know so many people, almost always analysts, who kind of terminate, but maybe they see the analyst once or twice a week. They're not talking about the patient's issues. They're talking about whatever they're talking about, psychoanalytic politics, culture, real politics, because the through line is the patient can't let go of the analyst, even though the patient doesn't really need analysis anymore. And sometimes those people leave and then they become friends. Sometimes they don't. But the idea that the need is to sustain the attachment and that that need is not inherently neurotic is where I'm trying to put the emphasis.
You said almost always analysts. That's quite an observation. Now, is that because there's a connection through the institutes, or is this something else?
Yeah, I think that we have set up a field, a system in which we never have to do what we require of our patients. Of course, that's an overstatement, and there are exceptions. But we analysts are involved with each other across time, and either it's because we're in the same institute, or we go to the same conferences, or we are in similar circles, so we bump into each other. We don't say goodbye, full stop, in the way, for example, that a patient of mine who was in a totally different field said goodbye, knowing that the chances that we will ever see each other again are very small. I think it makes a huge difference. We don't have to go through that long goodbye and mourn the analyst in the way that we require of our patients. It's the termination model. You've got to work through the loss. Well, first of all, who says? But even if you believe it, we don't do it.
And you go on to say, on that point, it's time we address these realities and query the absolute necessity for a formal termination process. When is it core to analytic change, and when might it not be? Certainly, most of us, including me, encourage people to take their time prior to leaving, time to review what has changed, what we have and haven't done together. And so we can address the why stop now? Despite our good clinical gains, might there be unconscious resistances and or anxieties embedded in my patient's wish, and you add in your own wish to end? And that's something you make a point about, that, you know, there are two people ending here, in an identical situation, but obviously both in a very meaningful relationship.
Yes.
I can read what you wrote about that, but before I do, why don't you tell me your thinking about it?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, we have not queried our subjective investment as analyst or therapist. I don't think it's necessarily different if it's just a therapy in ending or not ending. And I think that we are, as a field, variable in the degree to which we care about the sort of the good stuff that comes with terminating or fear the bad stuff. So what am I talking about? Well, I don't know about you, but there are times when it would be nice to know that tomorrow I have nothing to do and I can do what I want. I can go for a bike ride and meet a friend and read a book and write a paper, whatever I want, as opposed to I have patients from 7:50 a.m. until 6:30, right? That the kind of scheduled life that we have, no other field has. You know, even physicians, if you've ever been awake during a minor surgery, you will know that while you're lying there, they're talking. And they're usually talking hospital politics or political politics or something. They they are allowed to be just plain people even when they're doing surgery. We cannot do that. We have to be 100% or as close to that as we can in the moment. And there's a huge strain involved in that. So some of us want enough already. You know, let me have some time. Please leave so I don't have to keep doing this. On the other side, there is so much emotional richness, not to mention money, but leave the money aside for a moment. The emotional richness of the kind of connections that we can establish with patients are hard to come by in life because probably for many reasons, but in part because we impose enough discipline on the relationship to protect it from the sorts of things that can happen in personal relationships. And it can be really hard to give up feeling adored, feeling helpful, feeling wise, feeling generous, all the sort of good self experiences that we get when we're in this role. So some of us are pulled more toward never wanting to end, and others toward being done with this scheduled life already. And on the side, what I said before and didn't pick up is, and some of us, and you certainly hear this, particularly when you're newer in the field, I think, or when I'm talking to younger supervisees, you know, most of us are not independently wealthy. And with termination comes loss of income. And many younger therapists in particular, but sometimes older ones, get really terrified of that, which then becomes a reason not to end.
And we're focusing on the realities, and that's a reality worth mentioning for sure.
And it's a psychological reality too. It's not just literally about your bank account. It's about what it feels like to make money or not. And that can keep therapists in it longer than they might otherwise.
Before we go further, there's a sentence that you wrote in the paper that I want to ask you to elaborate. You say, "I'm convinced that a symbolic parental element remains latent in the analytic relationship." And I read that a few times, asking myself, you mean there's a point of view that says that there isn't a parental element remains latent and or manifest in the analytic relationship? I mean, to me, one of the essences of the analytic relationship is the analyst and has the privilege, the opportunity, to discover how their childhood is living in them and casting certain light on how they are living and seeing people. That's what we do. We help them see that. So share with me what I'm not understanding about that sentence.
What you just said is 100% correct, probably 99% of the time. But I'm not talking about what we help our patients discover about their personal lives. I'm speaking to the ways that the therapeutic relationship, and I think I want to say therapeutic rather than analytic, because I think this is a through line across degrees of intensity, although it is more true in an analytic relationship because of the intensity, that the through line is that there are ways in which not every patient, but many patients experience us as parents and themselves as children with us. And there are theories that reject that idea. You know, in particular, some interpersonal and relational theories really say this work goes on between two adults, not between a parent and a child. And yes, you're analyzing the patient's relationship to their family of origin, but you're doing it in the context of a mutual adult relationship.
So they don't acknowledge that there's a regression that goes on, and that's a gift to give patients. Yeah, some of them don't want it.
Absolutely,
you say?
I will leave the person's name unnamed, but I, for some time, taught with a good friend who very much felt that and would say things like, "There's no baby. What are you talking about? Regression? Ugh." I mean, I'm quoting. This person really felt that you do patients a disservice when you treat them that way because it is infantilizing and not useful.
Well, that is a whole subject.
It's certainly not my first.
No, it's a whole subject.
It is.
That we will step aside. But you have an example of a patient, Robert, in a once weekly psychotherapy. And rather than my read it, mm-hmm. why don't you walk us through what that experience was like for you, given that it refers to termination?
Sure. So Robert came to me. I actually don't know how he found me, but he came to me and we worked together once a week for maybe a year or two. I don't remember. He was a delightful person, alive, engaged. He had a partner with whom he had a good relationship, but he had some very significant anxieties that we worked on. And they were better, but we hadn't been working together all that long when COVID hit. And like many people living in New York, he wanted out. It was, for those people not in New York, it was utterly terrifying to be in New York during COVID. And I think everybody has managed to forget that now, that COVID is just a virus. But it was terrifying. So he and his partner left the city and went upstate. And I said, well, do you want to continue? We can use the phone or we can use Zoom. And we did. And we did it, I think we'd met twice on Zoom and once on the phone. And from my perspective, the sessions were okay. But from his perspective, they were not. He couldn't feel connected because of the screen. He liked the phone even less. And he said, I just want to wait. This doesn't work for me. I've always hated technology. I want to be in your office, in the same room with you. And I'll wait until that's possible. So I said, okay, it wasn't my place to argue with that. And he certainly was doing well enough that I wasn't worried about him. So 2020 came, 2021 came, sometime about 2 years later, I got in touch with him and said, I am finally going back to the office. Do you want to talk about meeting? And he took a little while and then he got back to me and said, essentially, thanks, but no thanks. I'm fine. Things are better than ever. And I don't feel the need for therapy. And I heard from him several times before and after that in ways that led me to believe that that was not a sort of cover, that he really was doing fine. So we could say maybe he stopped because he was doing fine and it had nothing to do with Zoom and telephones and all that. But I think that, in fact, he could not sustain the sense of attachment to me over the computer. And he left. It was an utterly abrupt termination that was not designed around his needs or lack thereof or anything else other than actuality. And so, no, I don't know. And one of the things about our field that I really hate is I would like to call him up and just say, how you doing? What happened? You know, where are you now? And I can't do it, or I feel I can't do it.
Let me ask you about that, because there is a couple of paragraphs in the paper about that question of contacting patients after treatment. And I must say, I don't recall it ever being written about, nor seriously discussed. I certainly know the experience, as we all do, about wondering, gee, I wonder what happened to, and you know, what their story became with all the questions that we were immersed in. What's your sense of it? I mean, I guess just to continue, you said I was curious and I wanted to find out. So just from the get-go, you're owning that this is for you and not for him. And maybe that's why you say I shouldn't, because you recognize that this is not for his benefit. This is to satisfy my curiosity.
I mean, I don't like the word curiosity there, because it felt more like I have an attachment to this man. I really have very warm and caring feelings for him. The relationship was abruptly cut by virtue of the pandemic, and I kind of miss the guy. And so it's more intense. There's more affect in it than the word curiosity embodies. but it's not for him. If he wanted right. to see me, he knows my door is open. And so, yes, it would be me trying to reignite something that he is either put away permanently or temporarily. And I just feel like that's beyond the scope of what I can do.
Let me ask you a question. We began today and we exchanged terms about rules versus guidelines. And you talked about how rules can be important. We just had an exchange where you said, I would like to satisfy, if not a curiosity deeper than that, I would like to reestablish, tell me if I have this right, an emotional connection with him that he isn't interested in establishing with me. And I would like to act on that, but I know I shouldn't, i.e. there's a rule. Now, is this an example of a rule serving to put a cap on, put a governor on, in this case, you're acting out your own wishes to use the patient for your own emotional needs? That may be a little harshly put, but you understand the spirit of it.
Yeah. I mean, basically, yes. Although what I was saying was I have the emotion. I don't need to establish an emotional connection with him. I'm carrying this guy around inside me. There's something about him that I feel connected to, and I would like to articulate that. It isn't like I want to become his friend and go to the theater with him. I just want to sort of establish where he is in life. And I think that doing that would not protect the treatment. So in that sense, it's one of those times where I know I wouldn't do it. It would feel wrong. It would make me feel intrusive. Now, that said, as you know, well,
do you need a rule for that, or is that just your, go ahead.
No, I don't need a rule for that, but the rule or something internal that has to do with you're an analyst here, Joyce, you know, you can want whatever you want, but you can't act on it. It's pretty well integrated. So no, I don't need the rule from the outside. I'm carrying it around inside me, but I also talk about calling patients during COVID. Right? Where I broke my own rule.
Yeah. Right. COVID was one of those things that challenged all our assumptions.
Everything.
Yeah. Staying with the realities, you make a very important point when you say it's widely recognized that the termination ideal rarely reflects actuality. Across the field, complete analytic endings are rare indeed. Both because some people leave precipitously and because people aren't always prepared to say a final goodbye. And you say some reduce treatment, as we talked about. But that's an important point, that this idealized termination is an idealized termination. And that for a host of reasons, reality reasons and others, doesn't happen so often. Which doesn't have to diminish our sense of the power and usefulness and healing ability of what we do.
Absolutely. It's particularly unlikely to happen when we and our patients are both in the field.
Right?
Because even if we terminate, we keep bumping into each other across time in 1,000 different contexts. It also happens sometimes when that isn't the case, when you're working in a small town. You're going to bump into your patients in the gym or the supermarket. It just happens. But that's different from deliberately saying, let's just move from this to something else.
About staying in touch after termination, you write, on the one hand, for some, their capacity to renegotiate the rules of engagement symbolizes a move beyond the transference and represents a powerful emotional achievement. For others, the need to preserve the internal objecti requires that the analyst remain largely unknown, and of course, at times we make the wrong call. Still, if we are able to revisit and renegotiate what went awry, therapeutic gains may result. That's quite a sentence, a move beyond the transference.
Yeah, I know. Some people would tell me that is itself an oxymoron.
Well, I think people would say, I guess I'm being one of the people that, you know, as I'm not saying anything unique, that life is filled and created through transferences. It's not that it only exists in the analytic setting. It's that we encourage it and take a careful look at it. And that, that to me is the beauty of the notion of a compromise. Everything is always a compromise between reality elements and fantasy elements. But when you say beyond the transference, mm-hmm. I guess you're meaning that, yes, of course there's transference in both directions always all the time, but that basically it's within social normal limits. I don't know. Give me words here. What do you mean by it?
That there is enough of a reality connection that is not transference-based to allow both people, and it really has to be both people. It's not that the patient becomes able to move beyond it. The analyst has to also. Sometimes that's harder. For them to engage with each other in a more mutual way that lacks the kind of acute asymmetry of the analytic relationship.
It's nicely
and
said.
I've seen it happen. Thank you. It's tricky. Because
you've seen it
I think
happen.
As the analyst, I've seen it happen in other, it happened with me once, and I have seen it happen with many of my colleagues over time. Somebody sees somebody and 20 years later, you know, long enough.
Yeah.
That it's almost like another life. They run into each other, whatever. And it's like, oh my God, how are you? Let's have lunch. I want to hear what's happened in your life. And that becomes not the beginning of an intimate friendship, but a kind of collegial warmth that involves the memories that both carry of the earlier connection in a new context, one in which they feel more like peers than not.
It's the 20 years that changes the shape of it to me.
Yeah. So if it's 6 months, I think much less likely.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I hope I didn't tell you this the last time we did this, but I was once at a wedding out of town and there was circle dancing. And I get up to dance and I break into the circle the way that you do. You can't see whose hands you're taking. So you just grab two hands. And one of the hands was a patient. And I had zero idea that she would be there. And we look at each other and we both do this kind of double take and laugh. And I mean, there was no way to say anything, but it was sort of both uncomfortable and kind of nice. It was just a moment. Going back to treatment, nothing like that ever happened again. But there was that moment. Had she been done with treatment, which she was not, I think we would have gone off into a corner and she would have caught me up on her life.
Let me ask you a question about that. So let's take the 20 years and borrow it and apply it. Do you imagine that 20 years after this treatment is over, and she relates to others about her psychoanalysis, that will be the top three things that she talks about in reflecting on it?
Absolutely, yes. There is a wonderful paper, and I do not remember who wrote it, about their memory of their analysis. And what did they remember? It was about Ernst Schachtel. And the story of the analysis was about how, after some very difficult session, he took the patient's hand, and the writing was, and that very shy man, meaning Schachtel, took my hand. That was what the person remembered from this very long analysis. I think that what patients take from analysis as memories are the moments when we break out of the frame and become real. Not because we broke a rule. I mean, I didn't break a rule. I was just at a wedding. But in that moment, we had a kind of human, unscripted, unchoreographed moment of contact. And I'm about as sure as I can be that that will stay in her mind more than, you know, whatever brilliant or stupid interpretations I made.
Which is not the same as saying is that that was the healing element. That it's uppermost
absolutely
in one's
not.
Mind. It's an important distinction because you can see how people could take that and run with it. And we need to honor it for what it is, but it's not exactly clear what it is, except that it's something that stays with one for a long time.
I think, I don't think of it as curative at all, but it's kind of like the punctuation that's created by the experience of the analyst's humanity with the patient. It's out of role. And for that reason, it has a lot of power.
Beth, to return to your paper, you write, Beth, a once weekly psychotherapy patient who has been seeing me for about 12 years recently said spontaneously, I think of therapy as psychic maintenance. It gives me a place to check in and a person I trust who gives me a perspective on myself and the people in my life. I can afford it. It helps. So why would I ever give it up? I think we have all heard that. And maybe even we've all said that. What's your reflection on it?
More than one. I do think that sometimes that is really what it is, and it is okay, I think, with this patient who will never go for analysis, who really does not want to go too deep into things. She wants to stay not on the surface, but she wants to stay where the surface is reachable. I become the sort of the compass that allows her to reconnect to childhood stuff momentarily, and in that sense keeps her going. So I don't really have a problem with it. She's not in love with me. I'm not taking the place of a love object in any kind of a tangible way, and that can happen, and that's hugely problematic. But I also think that I and she, and this would be true for any such treatment, have to ask the question, is there a downside? Is it possible that there is a way in which this is not good for her? And what that brings to mind for me is another patient whom I saw for a very long time and began to feel like she could be in treatment forever. There's lots of trauma, lots of stuff to talk about, but that at a certain point after many years, continuing to be my patient left her chronically in the position of a sort of somewhat helpless supplicant, dependent on my superior wisdom. I'm overstating it, but there was an element of that. And I started to talk to her about it and about the possibility that she was terrified to leave treatment because she really didn't believe that she had enough good stuff inside to make a go of it without me. And we worked on that and she terminated. And I feel like that was the right thing for her. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed working with her. I didn't want her to leave, but I somehow had the sense that this was doing her more harm than good at a certain point. I don't know how common that is, but I think it can happen.
Joyce, keeping our frame, I have to ask you to close our conversation reluctantly, speaking about not wanting to let somebody go. It's always a good time and always something to learn when we speak. Let me ask you to read the final paragraph of your paper.
So it starts with a word, but nevertheless, I'm convinced that termination remains an ideal worth holding on to, but loosely. When we encounter a patient who won't or can't end, or one who ends precipitously, we need to interrogate its meaning rather than to impose one. And at least rarely, we need to play with the possibility that perhaps this time things can go differently and just as well.
Need I say, it's a pleasure to learn how you think and to share how you think and feel with our listeners, who I'm sure will take pleasure in it as I do. Joyce, thank you.
Well, it is a mutual pleasure, so thank you back.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.